protecting America's shores today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. Coast Guard has 95,000 miles of coastline to protect, and they have to be ready for anything.
We have mounted automatic weapons on our vessels. That deters a lot of threats, I believe.
I ride along with the Coast Guard in Boston Harbor to find out more. Also, a drug cartel massacre in Mexico triggered by a law enforcement operation in Texas.
And the target of that operation was a drug trafficker, a Dallas native, who had fled to Mexico.
Plus, how a warmer and wetter Antarctica is becoming less white and more green.
There have been meadow grass species which have become established in different parts of Antarctica that scientists are busily trying to eradicate.
That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. Recent attacks in London, Manchester, as well as those in Kabul and Baghdad, they all serve as reminders of how much we rely on the authorities to protect us and how difficult it is for them to defend concerts or sporting events or shopping malls or mass transit. The U.S. has experienced this too, think San Bernardino or the Pulse nightclub shooting. Would-be attackers trying to enter the U.S., though, have two large oceans to cross, and obviously that's a significant layer of defense from anyone who wants to get here. Not an impossible barrier, though. I wanted to get a taste of what the people who patrol those waters, the Coast Guard, do, and what their job is like these days. So I joined them on patrol here at their Boston base.
So actually, where we're heading right now is where a lot of the activity with the natural gas tanker that comes in. So we're heading through the underneath the Tobin Bridge right now. All the local agencies send somebody out to come just to ensure that nobody's getting too close, just to kind of keep the way clear. If anybody does have ill intent with the tanker, we'll be able to react quickly enough to it.
How frequently do the tankers come in?
Bosun's mate, second class, Eric Vollmer, shook his head on that one. He can't say for security reasons. It's classified. If you don't remember what the Coast Guard is exactly, a quick crash course. It's the smallest branch of the military with about 36,000 active personnel. Began under Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, yep, him again, as part of the Treasury Department's mission to protect U.S. maritime economic interests. Today, the Coast Guard is not under Treasury, nor does it fall under the Department of Defense. Instead, it's the purview of Homeland Security, which suggests accurately that when it comes to terrorism, the Coast Guard tries to stop it closer to home. This is Lieutenant Karen Kutkowitz with Coast Guard Public Affairs.
We wear hats that are different every day. We could be doing fisheries out here in the North Atlantic, making sure our fishermen stay safe. We could be doing counter-narcotics in the Eastern Pacific, making sure drugs stay off of the American streets. We can be doing different things every single day.
Added to our traditional mission set has really been a increased focus on that security element that you're talking about.
That's Coast Guard Boston Base Commander Brad Kelly.
We've added a force that we hadn't had prior to 9/11.
What are you expecting? What are you preparing for?
We have mounted automatic weapons on our vessels. We have M16s that we can carry aboard boardings that we determine are higher threat. That deters a lot of threats, I believe.
Because something catastrophic coming from sea hasn't happened yet, they don't know what to expect. It's a massive task, partly because the ocean is so vast, partly because the Coast Guard budget is small relative to the other branches of the armed forces. Here at Coast Guard Base Boston, it's easy to think of their field of vision for their missions as Boston Harbor, but this is only one tiny area of the sea that the Boston base helps to protect. The day I boarded Cutter Seneca, it was undergoing regular maintenance and repairs to the tie-downs on the helicopter landing pad. If you glance at the outside of the cutter, there are painted symbols of what its missions have been.
Above the blue E, you'll see like snowflakes and then four little green leaves. Those all indicate drug busts.
Those drug busts that Captain E.J. Marone mentioned don't happen here in Boston usually. Two-month missions on the cutter far from Boston are the norm for the Boston-based crew. They sail into the North Atlantic, down to the Caribbean, to Cuba and Haiti, even across the Panama Canal and into the Eastern Pacific. Bosun's mate, Third Class William Southard, spoke to me about one recent mission in the Eastern Pacific to a boat that seemed to be moving a little too fast.
We were sent through the Panama Canal. We had one of our Marine Patrol aircraft spot a go-fast that was less than, think 15 miles away from us at that time. They had jettisoned their drugs. I actually had video of them putting the drugs into the water.
It's a typical ruse, he told me. Smugglers will run the drugs at night, and daytime they'll sit becalmed in their boats, pretending to be fishing.
We pulled up alongside the vessel, immediately jumped on board, patted them down for weapons, just a quick safety check, make sure that everything was safe for us to be there.
For the Coast Guard, a lot of this is simply about determining on the spot whether the people on the boat are really doing what they say they're doing, hundreds of miles out in the ocean.
We looked down around. They had no bait on board. They had no hooks. And really, the only thing for fishing gear they had was a few jugs and pieces of line that were strung together that they had thrown in the water. And then we waited for, 11 and a half to 12 hours to get full permission to bring them on board, treat them as detainees.
And finally, the Coast Guard had to sink the boat. There's a lot of fuel on board, and they can't tow the boat, and they can't leave it floating in the ocean. Coast Guard crew often say they have 360-degree vision, as well as long and short depth of field. Their eyes have to know what to look for on lonely little boats 150 nautical miles offshore. At medium range, those eyes have to know, for example, that a fishing boat traveling too slowly through protected waters is suspicious. And at close range, those eyes are trained on the shoreline, just as they were in 2013 after the Boston Marathon bombing, when the city suddenly had to consider possible follow-up attacks coming from who knows where. As Bosun's Mate First Class Chris Rantuccio told me,
when we're conducting our security patrols, we're taught to be vigilant and look at everything with a higher level of scrutiny than most civilians would. I mean, the last thing we want is to miss something on our patrol that could turn into the next, Boston Marathon bombing. So we're looking for, small objects that seem out of place, things attached to piers, backpacks, things like that. So that might be something that a normal civilian would not necessarily think is out of place, but I think that our training teaches us to be that way. When I'm walking around the city, I look at things differently than my girlfriend would.
The vision of the Coast Guard also has to be imaginative, as I heard from Captain E.J. Marone.
We practice for whatever we can think of practicing. We have, I would say most sectors, when they're doing their pollution exercises, we roll in sometimes a terrorism element to it.
How do you prepare for a cruise ship that comes into Boston Harbor and is taken hostage?
Interestingly, these are some scenarios that we have actually worked on. And that's, again, partnering with our local, state, and federal, meaning all the way from FBI on down, because there are different roles. If it becomes a hostage thing, we would turn it over to FBI. We become a mode of transportation to get them out there.
The Coast Guard seems to take it in stride, but the pressure of being constantly vigilant for many different scenarios while supported by a small budget, that is a daily challenge.
Sometimes it can feel overwhelming.
That's Lieutenant Karen Kutkowitz again.
It's tough to have all these missions, even though we are at the best at all these things that we do.
So that was how I spent my day with the Coast Guard a couple of weeks ago here in Boston. One other thing I spoke about with the crew that day was a mission that the Coast Guard is also charged with, dealing with migrants who are coming to the U.S. by sea. Often, they're refugees. And this is, according to the United Nations, World Refugee Day. For more on that, we turn to the world's Richard Hall in Beirut. Describe for us, Rich, the migrant and refugee situation. When you first started covering this story, that was, 2012?
Yeah, around 2012, yeah. Well, it was interesting at the beginning. There was definitely a sense among people fleeing from Syria that this wouldn't be a permanent thing. There was definitely a sense of optimism that this would end quickly. And you saw that in where they were going. People weren't heading to Europe then. They were going to Turkey. They were going to Lebanon and Jordan, countries neighboring Syria, because they thought they'd be going home.
So compare what was going on in 2012 to what you're seeing today. Like, how have those patterns of flight and numbers actually changed?
So with regards to Syria, the conflict has been static for a while now. And as the war dragged on and it became clear that it wasn't going to be over quickly, you later saw people making a decision to leave and go further afield and try and build a life somewhere else. So over the past five years, there have been these waves of people fleeing the country. 2015 was a particularly bad year. Everyone will remember the migrant crisis that affected Europe. You had people fleeing all the way to Europe, fleeing the violence in Syria. So I think when I first started in around 2012, there was around 500,000 registered Syrian refugees in neighboring countries, and it kind of trickled up over the years. In 2014, it was 4 million. Today, there's more than 5.5 million Syrians living outside of the country, and many more than that displaced inside the country. And the routes have also changed. So before, people used to leave Syria by land and try and get to Europe. The borders were largely open as a humanitarian decision by Turkey. Now those borders are largely closed. Turkey made a deal with the EU that saw it crack down on smugglers so people couldn't flee. So now people are mostly traveling to Europe by sea across the Mediterranean, which is a much more dangerous route.
Yeah, the time that you spent on that rescue ship in the Mediterranean last month, did you get the sense that a lot of refugees today, whether they're from Syria or anywhere else, have kind of given up any hopes of really ever going home again?
It depends on who you ask, really. If you ask a Syrian person, they will always tell you that they will go home. As soon as they can go home, they will. There's definitely a sense that they've left something that they missed dearly behind. Other people are leaving because they see no hope in their own country. And that was definitely something I felt on the boat. You had people coming from across sub-Saharan Africa, and they would say the same thing. They would say, there is nothing for me in this country. Those people were definitely trying to go away and trying to build a new life.
As you've been covering these tens of thousands of people fleeing their homes, has there been one moment or any moments that really have kind of stuck with you and kind of crystallized the whole situation?
Yeah, there have been a few, actually. I suppose it's these kind of small moments that stick out. There was one during the migrant crisis of 2015, when hundreds of thousands of people were traipsing across Europe, walking across borders. There was a moment where I'd spent the evening with a group of Syrian refugees, middle-class Syrians, English speakers, educated, all of them. We spent the evening together. We spoke about their lives in Syria. And when they crossed the border from Serbia into Croatia, I had to say goodbye to them. And I saw this group of people that were just like me, gathering their things together in the dead of night and heading off into this cornfield. They just kind of disappeared into this field of corn crossing this border. And it just made me think, you know, this could happen to anyone.
I was going to ask you what your biggest lesson has been. As you've covered migrants and refugees, that sounds like it might be one of them.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing is that people forget that these people are fleeing for a reason. They always have a good reason to leave. There's that famous poem by a British Somali poet, Wazan Shire. He says, no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. And they want to be safe, of course, but they want to go home too. They want to go back to the place they grew up and where their family lived and where they have memories. And that's something that people living in the West forget, I think.
So the UN designates this day, June 20th, as World Refugee Day. What can one day do?
It's interesting. I thought about this a lot. I think that I definitely get the sense that in Europe and especially in America since the rise of Donald Trump, there is definitely a fear about refugees, especially when you talk about them in these abstract numbers. People get scared. People get scared of the scale of the crisis. I think hearing the stories about people who have made it to the other side, trying to combat this fear that people have of these people and of these abstract numbers, I think anything that does that is a good thing.
That's The World's Richard Hall in Beirut. And before we take a break, I want to share another related story we've been working on about a family that refused to be broken up by a deportation order. The mom and the kids, U.S. citizens, joined the dad, who was sent back to El Salvador. His town is pretty, but it's controlled by gangs.
They say this is one of the worst neighborhoods in this town.
That's where you live.
But we feel safe here because they've taken us in. They've accepted us. But now we belong to them. That's what the thing is.
A family goes to great lengths to stay together. Their story on the show tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In 2011, a series of horrific killings were carried out in northern Mexico, not far from the Texas border. There's no official count of the victims, but they included a 7-month-old baby, a 15-year-old football player, and others who were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The killers were members of the Zetas cartel, out for revenge. ProPublica reporter Ginger Thompson investigated the killings over the course of a year. I asked her what happened during the attack.
Well, in March of 2011, a convoy of gunmen arrived in this small ranching community called Allende and several towns around Allende, and they began kidnapping people who were targets and anyone who happened to be with their targets. They took a lot of these victims to a ranch on the outskirts of Allende, killed them, and then burned their bodies. What we learned in my months of reporting on the story was that this massacre began with a DEA operation in Dallas, and the target of that operation was a drug trafficker, a Dallas native, who had fled to Mexico.
Yeah, that's a particularly troubling part of the story, and we'll get to that in a moment. You found records that indicate that people started calling authorities when the Zetas started these attacks, but nobody responded. Just explain how the cartels, the Zetas especially, have accumulated so much power in this part of Mexico that it actually affects how crimes are solved.
The Zetas sort of took hegemonic control of the region. They started by, you know, co-opting local police forces in the region, paying them off and threatening to kill those who had refused. And then it was the mayor's offices, and then it became military outposts in the region, and it was the customs office. And, you know, several people there said to me, you know, once they had control of the security forces in that region, they began getting involved in legal businesses. They opened hotels. They opened stores and shopping malls. The mayor himself said, you know, the Zetas lived in this town. They didn't just do business in the Allende region. They made that region their home. And he said, pretty soon, their children were going to school with our children. They lived next door. They sort of embedded themselves in society.
So the role of the U.S. in all of this, in some ways it sounds like you feel like it started in the U.S.
Well, this particular attack began, like I said, with a U.S. DEA law enforcement operation in which a Dallas DEA agent had managed to get a member of the Zetas cartel to provide him with trackable PIN numbers for the leaders of the cartel. You know, at that time, that was sort of an intelligence goldmine. It's very rare for a DEA agent to come up with this kind of information. But when the DEA shared that information with its Mexican counterparts, the information quickly leaked back to the Zetas.
Why would the DEA do that? I mean, they know that the Mexican federal police has ties to cartels.
There's no way for the DEA to conduct an operation in which the Zetas would be captured without the support of Mexican authorities. The DEA's own informants warned them, however, that this was precisely the kind of information that could get people killed. And for reasons that the DEA was unwilling to share with me, they ignored those warnings and decided to share that information, hoping that it would lead to a capture, and instead it triggered this massacre. The larger questions for me, though, go to what happened after the leak, because leaks happen when you're dealing with a government like Mexico. And in this case, I wasn't able to discover anything that the DEA did to try to get to the bottom of how the leak happened and to hold people responsible for that leak.
And the Trevino brothers, the kingpins with the Zetas, are they serving jail time?
They are. They're in a Mexican prison. Neither one of them has been charged in this particular crime. In fact, none of the dozen or so low-level police officers or gunmen who have been arrested in connection with the Allende massacre have been charged with murder.
Today, what is it like in the town around Allende?
Well, life has returned somewhat to normal. People go back out at night. For a long time when the Zetas were in control of this region, people simply did not go out at night. That's changed. People are back out on the streets. They roam around the plazas at night, but they are still leery of strangers. And they are still worried that the Zetas and the violence that they lived during that time could come back very easily.
ProPublica reporter Ginger Thompson, thank you very much for telling us this story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, a pretty big turn now to Australia, where scientists are looking closely at zebrafish, or zebrafish, as they say down under. But there's a catch when it comes to why they're doing it. My BBC colleague Phil Mercer picks up the story in a lab in Sydney.
So you're lifting him out with a spoon into the sponge underneath the scanner.
And I'm lowering the probe onto the area where the heart is.
Celine Santiago is a PhD student mastering new technology here in Sydney that's unlocking the secrets of these tiny tropical fish, which could shed new light on heart disease in people.
Believe it or not, the zebrafish is much more like a human heart than, say, a mouse heart is. So this is the zebrafish aquarium. So let's go in and see what we've got inside here. My name's Professor Diane Fatkin, and I'm the head of a genetics research group at the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute in Sydney, Australia. Well, what we're looking at here is some tanks of adult zebrafish. One of the amazing things about zebrafish is if you cut off a little section of the heart, it will actually regenerate and regrow.
And the big question is, could humans do the same after a heart attack?
And now we have very, very high-frequency ultrasound tools, which means that we can actually do an echocardiogram in a little zebrafish that's got a heart the sort of size of a grain of rice. And so this has really opened the door to using zebrafish to study adult-onset heart diseases.
So the zebrafish heart is very, very small, and they're such small creatures that being able to do this kind of really powerful technique in the zebrafish has been really amazing.
It's not only the possibility of regenerating damaged hearts that's being investigated, but also pancreatic beta cells that make insulin, the hormone needed to control blood sugar levels. The research is a collaboration with Sydney's Garvan Institute. Associate Professor Shane Gray believes the body's natural defences could hold the key.
Look, we've long known that the immune system is involved in wound healing and protection from infection, but this, our latest studies really show a direct role of the immune system causing tissues to regenerate. And what we find is that the cells that make insulin are conserved between humans and zebrafish, so that makes them, again, useful to study. And we find that when zebrafish have damaged insulin-producing cells, these same immune cells go rushing in, presumably to repair them.
In type 1 diabetes, the immune system destroys the cells that produce insulin. Professor Gray and his team are looking at ways to turn attack into defense.
Well, you could say the zebrafish is all heart. That was the BBC's Phil Mercer reporting from Sydney.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Writer Max Fisher says how you define the word terrorism can make a big difference.
When you call something terrorism, you're saying this is an emergency. It's not just isolated loners, and we need to think about it in this kind of big collective way, which is a big breakthrough for Western societies to use that label for far-right groups.
More on that still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The murder of a high school student outside of Washington, D.C. early Sunday morning has shaken the Muslim community across America. In Sterling, Virginia, after late-night prayers at a local mosque, a group of friends was hanging out. One of them was 17-year-old Nabra Hassanin.
Nabra was the oldest child in her family. She was the oldest of four daughters. Her mother and father are originally from Egypt. Her father is a limousine driver in suburban Virginia. You know, they were trying to live the American dream, and, you know, for them, sadly, it's turned into a nightmare.
It's still not entirely clear what happened that night, but Hassanin's body was found in a local pond on Sunday afternoon. Officials have a 22-year-old man in custody, and they're calling the incident road rage, not a hate crime. Arsalan Iftikhar is a writer and human rights lawyer. He was at the mosque on the night of the murder.
During the month of Ramadan, we Muslims have nightly congregational prayers at our mosques around the world, and they usually go until very, very late at night because we have a very early pre-dawn meal at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And so my wife and I were present at the Adams Center in Sterling, Virginia, which happens to be our mosque. We had finished the congregational prayers close to 1 o'clock in the morning, and I remember as we were walking to our car in the parking lot, I saw a group of youngsters, teenagers, maybe 8 to 12 of them, sort of, you know, joyfully debating where they were going to get their midnight snack, whether they were going to go to McDonald's or IHOP. And, you know, it's kind of a rite of passage in the American Muslim community for young kids, you know, who are visiting the mosque to go get a midnight snack before coming back for the dawn meals. And so that's why it stood out to me. And obviously, you know, we heard what transpired, the tragedy a few hours later.
Obviously, horrific news for this family of Ms. Hassanan and the people who attend the Adams Mosque. What have you been hearing from people since it happened?
You know, to be honest, it's not only shaken up the local Adams community, but it's shaken up the entire American Muslim community around the country. You know, as I mentioned, you know, because going to IHOP or Denny's late at night is such a rite of passage within the community during Ramadan, I think it's really struck home. It's hit a chord for millions of people around the country who now either feel trepidation or fear about letting their kids go. I mean, something important to keep in mind is that the group of youngsters that I saw were all visibly Muslim. And when I say visibly Muslim, I mean that they were wearing the hijab, the headscarf, and the girls were wearing an abaya, a long dress to the floor. And so, again, they're visibly Muslim. And so for, you know, millions of American Muslims who in the age of Donald Trump are sort of very aware of growing anti-Muslim sentiment and Islamophobia, this really hit home. It's really shaken up the entire American Muslim community.
Police say this attack did not appear to be a hate crime. They're now classifying it as a road rage crime. But for the past 2 years, we've seen a sharp upturn of anti-Muslim violence and hate crime. So how are you kind of situating what happened?
You know, what happened in Sterling was not an isolated incident. If you look at the totality of everything that we've seen in the days, weeks, and months leading up to this, a few weeks ago, many people remember there was a white supremacist in Portland, Oregon, who brutally murdered two Good Samaritans who were trying to help a young Muslim girl and her friend who were being, castigated on a local Portland bus. So again, you know, we're starting to see, you know, a great deal of uptake in anti-Muslim hate crimes. And I think it's really, really important to keep in mind that these are not just isolated incidents. And in many cases, a lot of these people are becoming emboldened because of the rhetoric that we've, seen from people like Donald Trump.
At the end of the day, in terms of how this tragedy is seen by the Muslim community, do you feel that whether it's a hate crime or road rage, will it make any difference to them?
Well, it doesn't make any difference because Nabra is gone. But again, what I really, really hope is that young Muslim kids around the United States, around Canada, around the West, do not feel scared. First, about their Muslim identity, but also about doing rites of passage, like, you know, going out to IHOP in the middle of Ramadan from their mosque. Obviously, we have to be more careful. You know, we need to let children keep their innocence.
Arsalan Iftikhar, a human rights lawyer and the author of Scapegoats, How Islamophobia Helps Our Enemies and Threatens Our Freedoms. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
Let's return now to a story we've been following since February. You might remember that hundreds of Jewish community centers, JCCs, across the U.S. were evacuated because of bomb threats. At Jewish cemeteries in St. Louis and Philadelphia, gravestones were toppled and damaged. The immediate suspicion was that these were hate crimes. Then in April, a Jewish teenager in Israel was indicted for the community center bomb threats here. But there's still no explanation for the cemetery vandalism. We sent the world's Daniel Gross to St. Louis, Missouri, and he found that for the Jewish communities affected, the case is far from closed.
I'm standing between the headstones of the historic Chesed Shel Emeth Cemetery in St. Louis. Some of the graves here are 130 years old. It's a surprisingly colorful place, with bright green grass and stones cut from pink and white rock.
Well, it's a beautiful spring day. There's barely a cloud in the sky.
This is Karen Oresti. She's the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, and she remembers walking through these rows, looking out at almost 200 cracked or toppled gravestones.
It was really quite sad. I didn't expect to be as sad as I was. And I think partly also was just that all the different things that have been going on in the community.
When the vandalism occurred in mid-February, it felt somehow connected to the bomb threats and reports Oresti was hearing of bullying against local Jewish students. But one good thing came out of the damage at the cemetery, Oresti says. It was an opportunity to talk about perceptions of anti-Semitism.
Have you come to any conclusions about whether this, in the absence of a perpetrator, can be called an act of hate?
I can't. I am an attorney by training, so I won't say it until I know it. Look, we won't call something anti-Semitism unless we really know it's anti-Semitism.
Oresti isn't the only member of the St. Louis Jewish community who's feeling uncertainty. I stopped by a Jewish synagogue called Shara Emeth, just a few miles away from the cemetery.
When you hear the word anti-Semitism, what is it in your mind?
Hatred.
Hatred. Okay.
Ignorance.
Anti-Semitism is ignorance.
Rabbi Jim Bennett is leading a workshop he calls the New Anti-Semitism. Most of the participants are Jewish people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. One man says it's important to save the word anti-Semitism for times when it's really clear. Rabbi Bennett starts projecting a few photos onto the wall. With each one, he asks a question.
How about this? Is this anti-Semitism?
Bennett shows a political cartoon and then a picture of a Jewish cemetery that was vandalized with swastikas.
How about this?
Yes.
So Jewish cemeteries desecrated with swastikas and other hate symbols, we are all in agreement, is anti-Semitism.
The next picture hits close to home, an aerial photo of toppled Jewish graves.
I want you to hold that image and ask the same question and think before you answer. Is that anti-Semitism? That's our cemetery in St. Louis. That's an aerial photo of the Chesed Shalama Cemetery.
We don't know.
It could have been drunken kids.
So we don't know who did this.
There were no swastikas.
What was your first reaction when you heard the news about the cemetery desecration? I think most of us leaped to the assumption, the conclusion, the certainty that it was anti-Semitism, right? And only upon more reflection did we calm down and say, wait a minute.
The conversation isn't always satisfying. One man brings up the JCC bomb threats, now believed to have been called in by a Jewish teenager in Israel. Still, the questions feel timely. Some participants say that since Donald Trump became president, prejudice has seemed more visible. One woman says that a year ago, she wouldn't have felt the need to come to an event like this. Back at the cemetery, Oresti points out a row of headstones that have been repaired. After the cemetery was vandalized, the Jewish community received an outpouring of support from Jews, Christians, Muslims, as well as local and national politicians. Today, Oresti says the cemetery looks better than ever.
It looks so uniform now, doesn't it? Boy, was this place pristine by the time they left. In 2 hours, it was like a vacuum cleaner had come by and just lifted it all up.
What hasn't gone away is the sense of unease in a community that hasn't forgotten about persecution of the past. I ask Oresti whether she thinks the city will be able to find closure without knowing who was responsible.
Maybe it's not always completely closure. There can be an end to a story, and yet until the next chapter in the story is written, there's at least some sense of calm. We keep looking back at history to learn from it, and whatever happens in the future, we're going to learn from that too.
For The World, Daniel Gross, St. Louis.
By the way, we've partnered with ProPublica to create a project called Documenting Hate. Together, we're working to collect stories of discrimination across the country. If you have experienced or witnessed a hate crime or have a story for us, please share it at PRI.org. The U.S. isn't the only country struggling with these issues. In London, a man rammed a van into a crowd exiting a London mosque in the early hours of Monday morning. Eyewitnesses said the man was yelling that he wanted to kill all Muslims. But the British reaction to this event wasn't entirely what you might expect.
Something kind of amazing happened in the way that people talked about that incident.
That's New York Times columnist Max Fisher.
It was immediately called terrorism by Theresa May, called it that. The British media called it that. Theresa May actually bragged that the police declared it an act of terrorism within 8 minutes. And this is just exactly the kind of attack that typically would not be called terrorism. It was committed by a guy apparently acting on his own rather than on behalf of a group. It was committed against Muslims rather than by Muslims, which is typically the opposite of what we think about as terrorism, even if we don't want to admit it. These are typically the kind of attacks that get described as a hate crime or as a disturbed loner. And those are not mutually exclusive labels with terrorism, of course. But there's been this movement really over the last 3 years since the rise of the Islamic State from a lot of people who are targeted by non-Islamist terrorism, particularly right-wing, far-right terrorism, which is really rising as well, to say what we're dealing with is also terrorism. And that has a ton of political weight behind it.
Is all this a sign that officials are willing to be more equitable in their use of the word, or that this violence is the new normal and we just need one word for it?
I think that there are a few bottom-up changes that are really transforming how we think about terrorism. You know, a big watershed was the 2015 attack in South Carolina where Dylann Roof, who is, you know, far-right white nationalist extremist but acting on his own, attacked a church in South Carolina and killed a bunch of people. And this was happening right as the Black Lives Matter movement was rising. And there's been this kind of movement among the racial justice activist crowd for a while to say, you know, systemic discrimination is a form of terrorism that we face that is just as severe as Islamist terrorism. They never really broke through until that attack because it just so clearly mirrored attacks by the Islamic State that were happening around the same time. It's also, frankly, something that the Islamic State unintentionally has kind of forced on us. There's always been this kind of fiction that every attack by an Islamist terrorist is part of this like vast global campaign by these super scary Islamist groups. And that is sometimes true, right? September 11th was in fact organized by a group with, you know, based in Afghanistan and with reach in all these different countries. But over time, there's been this kind of like smoke and mirrors where a lot of terrorist attacks from Islamists that are claimed by groups like the Islamic State are actually just disturbed loners acting on their own who kind of grab onto these groups as justification for whatever they want to do. You know, think about the attack in Orlando.
I was going to say sometimes the attacks fit description of terrorism and hate crimes.
Right, exactly. And like, you know, the guy who committed that attack, you know, who knows what was in his heart, but it sure seems like he was to a pretty large extent just motivated by his personal animus towards gay people and then kind of like whatever mental issues he was dealing with and grabbed onto the Islamic State. And the Islamic State grabbed onto him and said, oh, yeah, we definitely were behind this attack. And I think that forced all of us to kind of confront what a deeply blurry line there is between mass organized attacks and a crazy person who takes up violence for whatever, you know, reasons they have in their head that have kind of driven them to this. And that's scary because it means acknowledging that there's not as much meaning and significance in these attacks as we might want to think there is. And it also means there's not as much we can do. But it also in some ways is healthy to start to see that it's not always threats coming from these super scary 10-foot-tall groups that, you know, command everything throughout society. It's often it's just a crazy person acting on their own. That has also opened up for seeing, you know, if a crazy guy in Orlando who latches onto the Islamic State, if that is terrorism that we think of in a really serious way, then, you know, so is a white guy who's 40 years old in London who really hates Muslims. That is also terrorism in kind of the same way.
That was New York Times columnist Max Fisher. When you think of Antarctica, you probably think white, a pristine wilderness of ice and snow. But around some of its fringes, there's a growing shade of green. Thanks to a warming climate, mosses and even grass are increasing in some coastal areas. And a new report in the journal Current Biology says the process is picking up speed. Dominic Hodgson is one of the authors of the study. He's a scientist with the British Antarctic Survey and a frequent visitor to the Antarctic Peninsula.
We're typically landed by boats, so we come off a ship and we land on the shore. And the shorelines tend to be a fairly narrow strip backed by high glacial mountains with glaciers running down off the mountains into the sea. And then where we are landed, we're examining areas where there are moss banks, which have grown at least over the last 4,000 or more years in Antarctica. But what we're measuring now is with the warming, these moss banks are changing in the respect that their growth rates are increasing.
So in the background, glacial mountains, which are presumably white and blue, because that's what those icebergs look like. And in the foreground, it's green, like that moss. That sounds like the edge of a stream or something.
Yes, I mean, that's a very good picture you've painted there. The white of the snow, the brown of the rocks, and the blue of the sky is a perfect day on the Antarctic Peninsula. And the mosses occur generally at the lower altitudes, but where there's wet areas, so similar to the sides of a river, but where you get accumulations or sometimes the seasonal snow patches, where they melt, it's often damp, and that helps support the moss growth.
Yeah, so this is a pretty quickly changing area, isn't it? Tell us what you've discovered. I mean, you drilled down and pulled out these cores, and what did you find in terms of the speed of change?
Yeah, so the remarkable thing is that as these moss banks grow, they don't decompose into peatlands as they would elsewhere in the world, but they grow. And then the moss from a few tens of years ago gets incorporated into something called permafrost, which essentially means it gets frozen. So the moss gets preserved for all time beneath the surface. So we're able to drill into that and reconstruct the history of the moss banks over many thousands of years. What we found in this study is that the growth rate of the moss banks that we've studied has changed rapidly since around about 1950, and that we're attributing to the warming trend.
Right, so warming trends could also suggest new species moving in. Is that the case as well?
Yes, so it's warmer and wetter, and that enables new species to come into Antarctica. And in particular, there have been meadow grass species which have become established in different parts of Antarctica that scientists are busily trying to eradicate because it's an unnatural colonist.
How do these invasive species actually get there?
Unfortunately, it's primarily humans. We all travel around wearing clothes that are often clothes that we've worn elsewhere in the world, back at home, but also things like camera bags, which we take on holiday with us and rarely ever clean. So both our clothing and particularly our things like camera bags pick up little seeds and propagules, and we transport them all around the Earth.
How much does this bother you personally? I mean, as somebody who is invested scientifically in this part of the world, you see these changes. Is it upsetting?
I try and approach it objectively. I mean, we're witnessing the retreat of ice, certainly along the Antarctic Peninsula, at a pace that you can see the change from year to year. In terms of invasive plant species, I do take that relatively personally because I know that it's either myself or one of my colleagues or predecessors that has brought these things in, or indeed, you know, other visitors and tourists. So, you know, we really are responsible as custodians for these environments and making sure we don't change them. So I take that side of it personally. I really do check my bags and my pockets and my coat and my Velcro and all the rest of it, because I don't want to be responsible or feel that I could have been responsible for a new species becoming established.
So, Dominic, make the argument for us why this environment should be kept pristine.
So it's the same argument that you use to support national parks or any pristine wilderness. It's trying to preserve parts of the world in their near natural state and limit the influence of human activity. Humans have, through their technologies, have learned to travel at rates that are much faster than any natural dispersal processes. So we're introducing and changing environments at an unnatural pace. And the aim is to preserve the natural values of these regions.
Dominic Hodgson of the British Antarctic Survey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We mentioned earlier that today is World Refugee Day, according to the United Nations. To really pay refugees their due, we'd have to tell you all their stories. So let's end the show with a story of just one refugee. Her name is Mari Malik. Her family fled South Sudan and came to the U.S. when she was a child. Malik's now based in New York, where she's become a fashion model and a DJ. She's also founded a nonprofit dedicated to helping children from war-torn areas, especially South Sudan. Our partners at the BBC produce a short video about Mari Malik. Here's an excerpt.
Where I come from, South Sudan, we are very strong and resilient. We've been going through war for over four decades, and we are still sticking through it and still surviving and still living and still making things. So that is in my blood.
When you do become a model, doesn't mean you get a contract and then you become rich and famous and everything is awesome. No, no, no. It's hard work. Everything that I'm doing connects, because if I'm DJing, modeling, or acting, I always have to be doing it for a purpose and connecting it back to the story of where I come from. This is why I do this, to inspire refugee kids, to inspire anybody who's facing difficulties and think that they cannot get out of it. Yes, you can do it. To be strong, resilient, never give up on myself. That's how I've made it this far.
Mari Malik, a former refugee from South Sudan. She's now a model and DJ based in New York. If you want to hear more of her story, check out that BBC video over on our Facebook page. It's there right now. Just search for The World. When she spins, Malik goes by DJ Stiletto, and we'll leave you with a track of hers from a few years back, Love Is The Way, featuring singer Lenny Harold. This girl reminds me of the first time that I felt in love. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.